is Earth Files, the award-winning news site with the latest updates in science, environment, and real X-Files. Podcasting in-depth reports beyond the 6 o'clock news by Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Moulton Howe.
In August 2009, I reported a series of Earth Files and a coast-to-coast AM radio broadcast about the UFO phenomena at the British RAF Bentwaters, Woodbridge, and Rendlesham Forest in December 1980. Since then, I have received more military eyewitness accounts, some from people who have never talked before. One is Richard Bertolino, now 48 years old, living in Spring Hill, Florida. He left the Air Force in May 1981, traveled and worked around the world, and now drives over-the-road trucks throughout the United States. Richard entered the American Air Force in 1979, immediately out of high school. He was given a choice about where he would like to be stationed, and he chose RAF Bentwaters in England because his father had been stationed there during World War II. Richard Bertolino did basic and security training at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, and arrived at RAF Bentwaters in October 1979. Between October 1979 and December 1980, the only spooky subject that Richard ever heard discussed at RAF Bentwaters was Eastgate Charlie, a legendary ghost that haunted the East Gate of RAF Woodbridge. The legend was that since World War II, soldiers working security at the East Gate had periodically seen dark humanoid shadows walking in the fog at night. The Christmas holiday in December 1980 had been normal and uneventful for Airman First Class Richard Bertolino, until a little after midnight in the early morning of December 26th. Richard was on duty in Post Security 4 at RAF Bentwaters. He was in an alert response team for the weapons storage area that everyone there knew contained nuclear missiles, even though the United States had an agreement with Great Britain not to have nuclear missiles there. What unfolded for Airman Bertolino and his security colleague, Sergeant Hall, would come to be known as the first night of the RAF Bentwaters and Rendlesham Forest UFO mystery. Today, 30 years later, former Airman Bertolino now provides eyewitness testimony that one of the men who went into the Rendlesham Forest to identify mysterious fiery lights did, in fact, sketch a triangle-shaped craft encountered on the forest floor. That man was Staff Sergeant James W. Peniston, who sat next to Airman Bertolino on the bus later that night, when they went to drop off their weapons at the end of their security shifts. Sergeant Peniston showed Airman Bertolino his drawing of the triangle-shaped craft of unknown origin.
About 1 a.m., somewhere between 12 and 1 a.m., when we were going into the weapons storage area to do a security check on the perimeter, we have to stop and get clearance from the weapons storage area tower. We were sitting there calling the tower, and Sergeant Fitzhugh was up in the tower. As we called up to him, I'll never forget, we were sitting there, and I was leaning forward on the dash. Sergeant Hall was driving. He had his arms and chest up on the steering wheel, also looking up. And we saw what appeared to be a very bright falling star. It had a blue-green luminescence sparkle tail to it. We both were like, whoa, and we called up and asked Fitz if he saw it. And when he replied negative, both Sergeant Hall and I looked at each other and go, wow, that was close. And that was the immediate feeling that we got from what we saw, that it was close to us. Looked like it was falling between the two bases.
So what happens next?
We do our perimeter check, and all of a sudden, on the radio, someone starts yelling, there's a UFO out here. Well, at that time, it registered to me and Sergeant Hall that there probably is a UFO out there. And Security 6 got the call to go out there. That was Sergeant Peniston.
Sergeant James Peniston.
Yes. He went out there, and we went to a place called Bunker Hill because we knew it was the highest point that we could get to on base. It's just basically a hill in a flight zone with a bunker on top of it for air-based ground defense.
Because you and Sergeant Hall wanted to look for the UFO.
Correct. When we got up there, we could not quite see a long distance over trees, but one thing I'll never forget was we saw a luminescent glow because he was saying, the woods are all lit up. And in that glow, I don't know how to describe it. It's not like a light that continually traveled. You know, it didn't have that property of a flashlight or a light bulb that illuminated an area. It almost had a dome quality to it, like it lit a certain area and that was it. It was a strange light.
You were looking at what appeared to be half of a sphere of light out in the woods that you could see?
Correct. Probably about the size of a football field.
Wow. That big?
Yes, that big. It wasn't an object. It was just light. You know how a light will leave an area that's lit up around it and it fades out? This was an area that was lit up, but at a certain point it looked like it cut off from fading. It was just there. It just lit up that area. Does that make sense?
It does. And when you and Sergeant Hall saw this enormous sort of sphere of light covering a football field size, what did you say to each other?
I think probably some choice words, you know, holy was the lead into it.
Are you on radio so that you can hear what Sergeant Peniston is reporting?
Correct. He's not even out there yet. They were in the process of going out there when I remember Jim Peniston. He was saying that, yeah, the woods are all lit up. At about that time, he was saying he saw a blue and orange beacon-type light. Security control came back and said, well, be advised it could be a downed aircraft. And so they were told to go investigate. I'm pretty sure without the downed aircraft part, we probably couldn't have gone out there because it was off base. So they started going out there, and that was about the time probably I was going up the hill and we started seeing that. All of a sudden, Jim comes back because the light went out, the bright light. He goes, it's dark out here, and I'll never forget him saying that the blue and orange beacon light are still there. The people I remember, because security police and law enforcement, John Burroughs was law enforcement. We were on separate radio frequencies. So security police and law enforcement, we are one unit, basically, but it's two different divisions. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so the people that I know that were out there for sure was Master Sergeant Chandler, who was at the edge of the woods because he gathered everyone's weapons. He didn't want them going out there with their weapons. He stayed at his Jeep. Airman First Class Cabanasac, Airman Longero, and Sergeant Peniston were the people that I knew for sure by radio were out there.
Okay, and do you hear Sergeant Peniston talking with the others on the radio?
I hear him. He is taking control, and he was doing all the transmissions to security control. As they were going into the woods, I'll never forget the one transmission that first made my hair stand up, and it still does to this day. You can hear, you know, a little bit of heavy breathing walking through the woods. He's breathing a little heavy, and he says, security control, the object is about 150 feet in front of us. And then, I mean, it was just a matter of a couple of seconds. He comes back, and his breathing is a little heavier, and he goes, security, do you copy that the object is behind us now? That's one I'll never forget. I can't remember quite all the transmissions, but we relayed some of the transmissions from Bunker Hill until he left Cabanasac behind to do that.
Right.
Because we had a great triangulation being on the hill to them in the woods, to the object, to security control.
How would you explain that radio transmission of Sergeant Peniston of the object being 150 feet in front and then behind, all within what appeared to be seconds on the radio transmission?
From what he told me, it just glided through the woods. No noise whatsoever. Pretty soon they came back and we had radio silence. I still don't know how that happened because from what I understand, they still had their same radios, but we could no longer pick up transmissions after about 45 minutes or an hour.
As if there was electromagnetic interference?
Interference or
possibly move to different channels?
Correct. I mean, I was all excited about it. I was trying to listen to every word of it.
Right. So you were not allowed to go out into the woods?
Not while I was on duty. But the next morning, when we got off duty, me and a couple of other people headed out there right away. And that was really something in itself there.
We'll get to that in a moment. Let's stay with where we are. You're on Bunker Hill. When you suddenly cannot hear Sergeant Peniston, do you contact any kind of communication officer and say, we've lost contact?
No, they had called for radio silence.
Who called for radio silence?
Security control.
Why would security control call for radio silence?
Usually when you have radio silence, it's because somebody is in a situation and they don't want anyone talking over each other. But like I said, we no longer could hear anything after a little while.
Okay, and this is after you had been on Bunker Hill for about 45 minutes to an hour?
Correct.
And that would have been approximately 1 to 2 a.m. on December 26, 1980?
I think that's the correct timeline.
What do you and Sergeant Hall know happens?
We try and go about the rest of our evening doing our regular patrols, and because every so often we had to do security checks in certain areas and things like that.
So you left Bunker Hill?
Correct.
And you're in a Jeep or?
We were in a pickup truck.
And you're going on your security patrol. Did you keep trying to listen on a radio to see if you could pick up Sergeant Peniston again?
Oh, yes. We had the radio in the truck, and each of us also had a side Motorola radio that we kept switching between. I believe there was three channels on it, three or four channels, and never could hear anything else.
And from your point of view, that is unusual.
Absolutely. And the next thing I know, we get picked up from our patrol duty by the relieving. We were C flight. Morning flight was A flight. They were coming on duty, and they'd drive around in a bus and drop off and pick up the different posts. Now, I don't remember if it was when we were going to turn in our weapons or if we were heading back to the dorm, but I sat right next to Jim Peniston, and we were talking about it, and he seemed shook up. You could tell that something happened to him.
What in the world happened out there that they called for radio silence? Did you ask him that?
As a matter of fact, I did. I go, what happened? You know, because I was, like I said, I was excited about the whole situation. And Jim says to me that it's a good thing that they couldn't take their weapons out there because he was afraid that him or someone else might have shot at this thing when they first approached it because it was so different, so different, you know, that they didn't know how to react to it. And he said if one of them would have shot it, there would have probably been a pair of smoking boots sitting there.
Meaning that it would be so powerful in its reaction that if there had been a human shooting at it, the human would have been disintegrated?
I think he meant that they were so far above us that it's not even funny. You know, their technology was so far advanced to ours that a bullet would be a joke.
Do you remember what else happened? What did he say? What was he doing?
He was describing some of the situation, and he pulled out this little notebook that he used to write incidents in, like if he was called to an incident. He always kept notes. Well, he pulls out the notebook, and he diagrams what he saw out there. It was kind of diamond-shaped with tripod legs, and he explained that it wasn't like any metal he had ever seen. I'm really getting into this, and we get in, and as a matter of fact, it was as we were going to turn in our weapons, because there were actually people there as we turned in our weapons, Izod shirt, khaki-style pants, military haircut with glasses, that took Cabanasac, Longero, and Peniston for questioning, for debriefing.
So these were like intel-type people waiting, or people with other authority?
Absolutely, because they had the authority to take these guys off and debrief them. And I think one thing that drove me nuts from that day forward was, here's guys that we put our lives on the line for each other. We would fight side by side and die with each other if we had to. These guys wouldn't talk about it anymore. I almost felt like, I felt kind of betrayed, you know, because they wouldn't even talk to me about it anymore.
You're shut out.
I don't know if I would call myself shut out. They shut in. I mean, we all still got along, but anytime it would be brought up, they just could not talk about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What was said to them to clam them up so tight, I have no idea, but I would like to talk to Jim about that one of these years.
When you heard Colonel Charles Hault in my interview with him, broadcast on Coast the night of August 27th?
Correct.
What was your reaction to hearing your former deputy base commander at RAF Bentwaters saying the lights that he encountered in the forest on the 28th of December were, quote, extraterrestrial in origin, close quote?
Thought it was great that he had the gumption to come forward. I mean, I saw three people that I was friends with that wouldn't even talk about it anymore. So their power to shut people up is pretty strong.
And I wonder who the they are.
As far as my vision into the situation, it was military. What part of the military? At the time of the situation, I guess they were OSI. That's what I thought.
Well, you do know that there are a lot of people working for the National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency who wear uniforms in various military positions, but they actually report to and get their checks from DIA or NSA.
And at that time, if you would have said NSA, I would say, what is that, a division of NASA?
You did not know about the National Security Agency in 1980.
No, I did not.
Did you know when you were at RAF Bentwaters that there were nuclear weapons in the weapons storage area?
Yes.
I think everybody did.
I know. I mean, and it was so funny because they even had public maps of the two bases. And on the Woodbridge base, it actually said it, non-nuclear weapons storage area. And on Bentwaters, it had weapon storage area with the double fence, the concertina wire, the bright lights, you know. I mean,
Richard, what was your thought when you realized that it had taken Colonel Hault 30 years to say what you all thought back then was the truth, that this was extraterrestrial in origin?
It still took a hell of a lot of nerve for him to do that. Even after all these years, I mean, I applaud the man.
Why shouldn't the truth be the first line of explanation?
Well, I'm sure that he has a military pension that he has to worry about, and that would have been a big concern for him, I'm sure. I still think it takes a lot of gumption to do that because they can make things miserable for him. I mean, his pension could suddenly stop coming, and though it's a paper error, you know, they, whoever they are, have the power. And I hate to say it that way, like a conspiratorialist, but, you know, it's true.
Did you ever have any discussion with Colonel Hault?
No, I didn't. I did see him out in the woods that morning. The person I talked to out in the woods in the morning was Captain Morano.
After you got off the bus with Jim Peniston, what happened?
As we got to security control to turn in our weapons after duty shift, and as we were getting off the bus, there were gentlemen there dressed like khaki pants, Izod-type shirts, you know, polo style with sunglasses. And they took Cabanasac, Longero, and Jim Peniston off somewhere. We no longer saw them when we turned in our weapons.
So were they waiting as the bus pulled up like they had an assignment and that they had three people that they wanted off that bus?
Absolutely.
Did Jim Peniston say anything to you, like, who are these people, or?
No.
What happens?
They go with them, and we turn in our weapons. And I was the person with the car, so we all decided that we were going to go back, get out of uniform, and go out to the woods where the incident happened. I can't remember everyone who went with me, but I do remember my immediate supervisor, Sergeant Donnie Dillard. He went with me, and one or two other people. As soon as we get out there, we see some security police vehicles. No British police whatsoever. It was my understanding that the night before they showed up, because we had to call them to let them know something was going on in the woods. We were in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And Sergeant Sandler said to me that two bobbies pull up, asked what was going on. He tried to explain to the bobbies what was going on. And they said, have a good night, and drove off. And Captain Morano was out there, and he sees us coming out, and he's like, boys, come here, look at this. And what he was showing us was a triangular shape in the ground of where three circles were. And the thing that got me the most about it was that where these things went into the ground, there was no pine needles. It was straight down to dirt in a circular, you know, like where the part that touched the ground, there was no pine needles. Cut out almost circular, like you would use a coffee can and cut them out of the way. And Captain Verano goes, look at this. He took a Geiger counter, and it would register, it would start ticking as you would go to the center of it.
At the center of the triangular pattern.
Correct.
What did he say that amount of radiation was?
It was basically just more than background, but it was more than normal.
And nothing was detectable where the bare circles were?
Not that I remember. What stood out was how clean it was to the ground. I would say that they were approximately plate size, so that would be 9-10 inches.
Across?
Correct. And they seemed to be about 4.5 feet apart. It looked like it was cut out like a cookie cutter, and they went right to the dirt. There was no pine needles to the dirt, which had to be at least 1 inch to 3 inches thick.
Was there any damage to any of the surrounding trees?
I did notice that there was a couple of broken limbs up high in a couple of trees. I think the thing that stood out to me the most was the fact that there was no animals out there that morning. You could see the prints where the deer had been running to get out of there. This morning, there wasn't an animal anywhere.
Not even birds?
Not even birds.
So was it unusually quiet?
Oh, it was extremely quiet. And I know when we crested out of the woods there, I noticed there was this one farm there, and every cow was huddled in a corner. I mean, I've never seen a scared cow, but those cows were frightened or something. I found out later that there was actually a couple of other spots where it supposedly, quote, landed, but I never did see those.
So maybe three sites in all where there were the same kind of triangular pattern of circles?
That's what I understand, yes. I think the craziest part of the whole thing was that morning, the void of animals. And to see those cows huddle in the corner, and I had never known about the firelight lights that Colonel Holt was talking about,
right,
where they thought that the farm was on fire. To see those cows in that corner like that, I wish I would have had a camera then, because it was one of the most bizarre things I'd ever seen.
Thanks for listening to this Earth Files podcast from the edges of science, environment, and real X-Files. Go to www.earthfiles.com to see more than 1,000 Earth Files reports with photographs, drawings, and documents. And visit Earth Files every day, every week, for new reports and new podcasts. That's www.earthfiles.com.